Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, you can hear it, Diane.
Welcome to The Nonprofit Coach with Ted Hart, the most listened to radio show in the nonprofit sector, dedicated to helping your charity succeed. It's no secret that combining online and offline techniques is the key to fundraising success, and practical nonprofit management advice is what you need. The Nonprofit Coach with Ted Hart is the perfect landing point to learn from experts around the world who provide advice you can use. Ted Hart is without a doubt one of the foremost nonprofit thought leaders. Also a successful author, his books range from Successful Online Fundraising to Expert Nonprofit Management. Guests on the Nonprofit Coach are leaders in their field who share their insider tips and trade secrets in a conversational style both the experienced and novice will benefit from. Ted lectures around the world, but now he's here for you. From the latest in charity news, technology, fundraising, and social networking, Ted and his guests help you and your organization move to greater levels of efficiency and fundraising success. This is a live call-in show. Add your voice by calling 347-324-3080. After the show, you can find all our podcasts at tedhart.com. Click on Radio. Don't forget to dial 347-324-3080. Now, welcome the host of the Nonprofit Coach, Ted Hart.
And welcome to this latest edition of the Nonprofit Coach. Thank you so much for joining us. Wow, this has been a bit of a bumpy start for us. When we first tried to take the show live a few moments ago, the servers at Blog Talk Radio appeared to be down. But thankfully, all the gremlins are gone, and we are here live on the Nonprofit Coach for a really, really terrific show. The Ultimate Telephone Success Podcast is being created right here today with Anthony Alonzo as our speaker and our page two expert. As the announcer mentioned, this is a call-in show, so I hope that you'll call in and ask questions of Anthony when we get to page two. And that number is 347-324-3080. You can also, if you're super shy, email me at tedhart@tedhart.com to ask your questions there. But as always here on the Nonprofit Coach, we start with page one news. And for up here on page one news, we have Eva Aldrich is here with us for the CFRE Minute. Eva, first of all, thank you for your patience in getting the show started. It was a little bit of a technology glitch here. I guess those things happen. But we are now live. And Eva, welcome back to the Nonprofit Coach.
Thanks so much, Ted. It's always good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. So bring us up to speed on what is happening over at CFRE.
Oh, quite a few great things, Ted. First of all, we've got 158 new CFREs in the March 2007 class, so a shout-out to them. And we've got an eager bunch, too. They're going to be in the next testing window, and that deadline's April 5th. So anyone who's wanting to be a CFRE by the middle of the year, that's your opportunity next. But beyond
that's
that,
great. Those
what
are
I really
good
like
numbers.
They are. I mean, we are thrilled. The CFRE community is so supportive, and the fundraising community is so supportive. I mean, we continue to grow, and that really makes us glad because our whole purpose is to serve the nonprofit community and make certain that fundraisers know best practices in fundraising, which is good for absolutely everyone.
That's right. That's right. You're deep in conference season, so tell us all about the great contacts you're making at conference.
Oh, well, you are right. We are going to be a little bit of everywhere, from the AFP conference in San Francisco, looking forward to that, but also going to the conferences of our partners around the world with the Fundraising Institute of New Zealand, the German Fundraising Association. We are on the move. So you can go to our website at cfre.org and see our various partners. If we are not at their conference this year, we usually will be there next year. So always feel free to get in touch with us to see where we'll be and what we were, because we want to communicate.
And that's a great way to connect with people and answer questions about how they can become actively involved in the program.
Absolutely. And one of the things we're really looking forward to communicating with folks as we see them and also a little closer to rollout time is that we are developing new and better ways to help individuals prepare for the CFRE exam. By the middle of this year, we are going to have a practice exam available, so that way individuals who really want to know a little bit more about what is the CFRE exam like will be able to have a practice exam so they can gauge where they are in terms of their preparation and level of knowledge. And by the end of the year, we'll also have a robust study guide that will be of help to them. So we're just really working in order to make sure that people who want to get the CFRE are well prepared and they feel they have the tools they need to be successful.
Well, that sounds like that gives people an opportunity to learn the way they naturally learn and give them an opportunity to fit it into their busy schedules and still be able to become certified.
Absolutely. And throughout this whole process, we are having strict firewalls between the exam development process and the educational resources process, as is required by our National Commission for Certifying Agencies certification as a credential. So that way people know that, again, these things are being prepared in a way that upholds the integrity of the CFRE credential and its accreditation.
Which is important to, obviously, the credibility of the certification. And the exam continues to change as the profession continues to change.
Absolutely, Ted. And you know, I think one of the things that really not many people realize is that the CFRE credential is the only accredited credential for fundraisers. So that's something we are very proud of and we are pleased to put resources into, because by being accredited as a credential, people can be assured that the CFRE credential is doing what it's supposed to do and that it really is a high-quality, valid credential that supports their hard work and dedication as fundraising professionals.
That's right. Well, very important work. Any other announcements for us as part of the CFRE Minute?
I don't think so, Ted, but I will say on a personal note, I think you and I should get together for lunch sometime because I think we are neighbors now in the same building.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, moved to 225 Reinecker's Lane, and we are thrilled with our new headquarters here.
Likewise, we are. So we're on the sixth floor, so we'll have to get together sometime.
Let's do that. Well, Ava, thank you so much for being on the Nonprofit Coach today and bringing us up to date on the very important work of CFRE. And just to let everybody know and remind you that we are broadcasting live over on Facebook today, as we normally do, and we will add CFRE.org to the comments and to the information that we share on that site so that you can find the website right there without any problem.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Ted.
Thank you, Ava. Next up here on the Nonprofit Coach on page one, we have Jen Bokoff. Jen, thank you. It was really great to see you at the GMN conference. How are you doing and what's new over at Foundation Center?
Yeah, it was great to see you too at what's now called the Peak Grant Making Conference. I keep saying GMN
Peak
too,
Grant.
But they have their exciting new name, Peak.
Yeah.
So that was a big deal this year.
I guess old dog. I'll have to work on that. You're right. Peak Grant Making is the new nomenclature there.
I know. Who would have thought GMN rolled off the tongue easier, but we got used to it. So exciting new times for them. I thought what I would share with your audience is a little update on a blog series that we've been doing over the past 2 months with Glass Pockets, which is our transparency initiative, and GrantCraft. So for the last 2 months, we've had a blog series available at grantcraft.org/fundinginnovation, and it features leaders from philanthropy who are funding at the intersection of innovation and technology. And for me, I had a really fun time editing this series because the thought leaders that we invited to write really took a lot of different angles. So we heard, for example, from the Bush Foundation about how they're funding the development of the process of innovation. So they're not even funding innovative ideas, they're funding how people develop innovative solutions. And then you have others like the Vodafone Foundation, which has its wireless innovation project competition, and a bunch of others who have shared just really interesting approaches for how they tackle this strategy. And so folks can read those blog posts, but then we also have an event that's tied to this that's open for funders and nonprofit professionals for free out of our San Francisco office on April 13th, and it will be live streamed as well. So anyone who's interested in hearing from funders, I think we have Jim Bildner from Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. We have someone from Cedric Brown from the Core Center for Social Impact. We have Shannon Farley from Fast Forward, and then Danny Harris from the Knight Foundation. They'll all be panelists at this free event, and they were all part of the blog series as well. So again, talking about the intersection of funding innovation and funding technology.
That's terrific, and we'll post the link to the Foundation Center of San Francisco site so that folks can go directly to that information.
Sounds great. So that was one update, and then maybe the only other update that's worth sharing is a little teaser about a project that we're working on through our Issue Lab platform, issuelab.org, which regular listeners to your show have heard me talk about, but it's one of my favorite things that we do because it solves the problem of the black hole of knowledge from the social sector, because we organize published reports across a variety of issues and approaches. And so coming out in beta form this spring, we're going to have a part of the site that's solely devoted to sharing evaluations. And part of why I'm so excited about this is I think, especially having worked at a foundation, I know how much foundations spend on commissioning evaluations, and then so often it sits on a desk read by very few people, and that knowledge is never shared with folks. So for me, I'm really excited to have a place that hosts and also encourages the sharing of different evaluations so that foundations around the globe can learn from what others know. So if you want to get in on the beta version, feel free to send us evaluations that you want shared, and I'll probably be back on the show in a few months to announce that that beta has launched.
That's terrific. Well, and we're also posting today over on Facebook, where we are programming live today, the link to issuelab.org, so that folks can pick that up there and connect with you directly at Issue Lab.
Terrific. Thanks, Ted.
You're welcome. So anything, any other update? Those are some pretty good updates from San Francisco and from Issue Lab for Foundation Center today.
Yeah, no, I know you have a packed show, so I'll let you get to it.
We do. Well, Jen Bokoff, thank you so much again for being back here from the Foundation Center, bringing us up to date on the Foundation Center Minute. Thank you.
Thanks.
And now we're going to head right on over to page two. Anthony Alonzo is the president of Advantage Plus and has 25 years of experience in direct marketing. He's often called on as an industry leader, speaking on telephone, plan giving, and social media marketing. His expertise ranges in education, healthcare, social services, and the arts markets. Over the last 25 years, he has had a very prestigious list of clients that he has worked with, from the United States Naval Academy Foundation to Oxford University and London School of Economics, just to name a few. Anthony has also been a tireless servant to AFP. He has served three terms on the AFP Foundation Board, founding member of the AFP Industry Partners Council, and is currently an officer of the New Jersey Chapter Board of AFP. He and his clients and the expertise that he has brought to the industry have raised well over $250 million for the charitable sector within just the last 5 years. Welcome here to the Nonprofit Coach, Anthony Alonso.
Thank you for having me, Ted. I'm glad to be on. You had some great people on before me, so I hope I can be as good.
Well, I'm sure you can. I mean, you are a noted expert in the industry, and certainly with a lot of experience with success in telephone outreach for fundraising and for prospecting. So I know we want to cover a very broad range of services that you have expertise in, but we are letting folks know that this is the ultimate telephone success podcast that we're creating here today. So we want to make sure that we're covering a wide spectrum of the use of telephone in fundraising. So if you don't mind, let's start off by telling us a little bit about Advantage Plus.
Sure. Advantage celebrated its 20th year last year. We started with the premise of not being a telemarketing firm per se, but being a fundraising consulting firm that used the mass instruments of mail and phone to reach out to the lower end of the giving pyramid and move those folks from the lower end to become mid-level donors and ultimately to major gifts. So the premise was, if this was a major gift solicitation, what would we do? How would we use the mass instruments of mail and phone to personalize the appeal as much as we can and to solicit folks? Because we're not, I always like to say, we're not in the business of selling vacuum cleaners. We're in the business of raising friends. And so how you do that is very different than how you sell any other type of service through telemarketing. And so the approach we take is to send out pre-call letters signed by a volunteer or multiple volunteers, making the ask. In an ideal face-to-face solicitation, that's what you would do. And then have that followed up by telephone solicitations by callers, either at a university setting or off-site if you're using a firm that specializes in this. The end result is higher average gift sizes, better conversations with prospects. In essence, the goal always has to be to leave everyone you speak to feeling good about the institution. Like I always like to say, whether they say yes, no, or maybe, that's irrelevant. If we can do that effectively, the money will follow. So that, in essence, is our philosophy with every one of our client institutions.
I can't think of any other form of fundraising that has been more disparaged than telephone outreach, telephone fundraising, telephone solicitation, whatever, you know, nomenclature we want to use. Yet as I remind people, and you certainly in your work are able to remind people, is that it can be highly successful. So while it can be a target and certainly it can be abused, it is, I think, an important part of a well-run, multifaceted fundraising approach. Because not every donor responds to a direct mail letter by itself. So let's sort of shift into, I think, some of the bedrock innovation that you brought into the industry many years ago, and that is that this is an integrated approach to fundraising. This isn't just opening the phone book and calling people and begging for money, which I think a lot of folks that are not, you know, a professional in this business might think that that's what's happening. But there's a lot of work and strategy that goes into a successful campaign that integrates phone into other services, and it's through that integration that you actually get success. Is that right?
That's correct. And, we typically spend 2 to 3 months designing a program with one of our client partners before we ever make a phone call. And again, whether you're using an outside firm or you're doing it yourself, that's the strategy that needs to go into place. It's not just a matter of deciding to make cold calls one day. That strategy is not going to ever be successful. You have to plan out what the what the prospect wants to know about, what the prospect's interests are, look at the data, do analysis of the data, set specific ask amounts based on previous giving before you ever make a phone call. Otherwise, you're setting yourself up for failure. I think another integral part is to make sure that you have very trained callers making the phone calls. You know, in the old days, the assumption was that volunteers are the best callers because they know the organization and can make the phone calls. The problem with that strategy is a lot of times it's difficult to get people to come in when they volunteer. A well-run effort where you're trying to reach out to, you know, 5, 10, 15,000 people requires people to show up. It's also difficult to train them to make the ask. A lot of times they like to call and say, you gave $50 last year, can you give $50 again? There's no strategy to upgrade, and it's difficult to train volunteers to do that. So there's a reliability issue there. So there has to be some very good training of the calling staff. And that begins with you're not making telemarketing calls. I like to say you're making friend-raising calls. You want to thank the prospect and inform the prospect. And if you do that, the money will follow.
Right. Isn't part of the issue that charities need to take into account in their strategy of using phones is the sort of desensitized nature of the of your prospect pool? In other words, while you may have a great group of volunteers, they're calling into households that are already sort of sensitized to rejecting phone, to not having a conversation. And so I think while there might have been a day where successful volunteer phone-a-thon could be truly successful, and I think there are still circumstances where limited use of volunteers can be used, it really takes a well-trained professional to have a dialogue with someone who is immediately probably starting inclined not to have the call, but perhaps by talking to a professional are happy that they had the call by the time the call ends.
I would agree with that. And that's part of why we always recommend that a pre-call letter be sent out so that it's not a cold call. Folks, let's face it, are inundated nowadays with telemarketing calls from every area of society. What a lot of those calls have in common is that you and your audience has probably heard this at home. The person will get on the phone and it goes something like this. How are you today? I feel that's a very disingenuous question from an outsider that doesn't know you because, you know, the person on the other end probably doesn't care if they don't know you or they're not part of the organization. What those telemarketers need is an icebreaker. And so they're trying to draw the prospect into a conversation. Where we recommend the pre-call letter is the pre-call letter, in essence, coming from the client says, you're going to receive a phone call, you're going to be asked for money, and here's why. And I like that letter to have what I call the sizzle, which is, this is why I give back. This is why I believe this hospital is great for our community. This is how it saved my life or my mother's life or et cetera. And then the case for support, which I like to call the stake, and then a specific ask amount. What that does is it really changes the dynamic of that phone call from a confrontational telemarketing call to a call where the caller is saying, did you receive the letter from Mary Smith or Jane Smith, whoever the letter signer was? And that draws the prospect in rather than, how are you today, into a conversation. Yes, I received that letter. How did you feel about the goals that Jane Smith or Mary Smith wrote in the letter? And so there now becomes a dialogue, and it doesn't become your standard telemarketing call. We already know when calling into
this prospect. Right, because you're referencing something that they have a connection to maybe someone that they don't necessarily know, but about an organization that they care about, because you've done that pre-planning, because you not just the letter ahead of time, but understand a little bit about who you're calling and why you're calling them. Again, back to not just opening up the phone book, but a lot of sort of data analysis and sort of metadata that comes into big data, where you're drawing in all sorts of valuable information into that call to make sure that that person is known and valued and the conversation can be one that's meaningful.
And that's critical. And the letter also serves to thank the prospect as well. And more importantly, Ted, it puts the letter signer, the volunteer letter signer, in the role of the solicitor rather than the caller. The caller becomes a facilitator. They're calling to follow up on that letter. The solicitor is the letter signer, which best practices are that that's a volunteer.
That's right. That's right. And when, help our audience sort of understand the evolution over, you've got 25 years of experience, because I think, you know, telephone outreach and the advent of social media and how you cost effectively integrate direct mail and all of that as an integrated campaign is not where telephone solicitation started. So can you share with us a little bit of your experience over 25 years and where this became much more cost-effective by making it much more interactive?
Sure. Well, you know, going back 40 years with the first Yale campaign, which was conducted by the great Bill Fried from IDC, which you may be familiar with, Ted, it was just a matter of picking up the phone and calling folks. And you reach them because they have landlines. Over time, there's been an evolution, a proliferation of caller IDs, people using cell phones, people using social media, texting. And so while the reach rates are no longer what they used to be 25 years ago, we'd say we can reach 90% of donors and 85% of non-donors, acquisition prospects who have never given before. Those rates now are significantly lower. A good program that's well run is going to reach 70% of donors and somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% of non-donors because of all the caller ID and the cell phone usage. So that's been a shift. In order to combat that shift, there has to be an integration with direct mail for those people that are not picking up their phone and not being reached out to. Email even. We're sending out email pre-call material before the phone call instead of sending out a hard copy letter in many cases with links back to videos for clients so that if they're not opening their mail, they're getting the email solicitation. So that integration has to happen. With many of our clients, we also on social media let them know the folks that are in tune with the client's social media that phone calls will be starting and that they should look out for a letter or a pre-call email. So we've tried to coordinate it all together. At the end, a well-run program is sending out a direct mail to those that were unreachable. Now, I hear the same things you hear, obviously, about telemarketing and it being dead. The problem is that it's the second most effective way still to raise money for an institution other than face-to-face. It raises more than direct mail, and it also gets higher average gift sizes. So there's no way around that fact still. So even though the reach rates are lower and it's getting more and more difficult to reach folks, it still yields the best results in terms of average and dollars with the exception of face-to-face. And obviously you can't reach out to, you know, 20,000 people through face-to-face.
Right. So I think you've shared some important data here, and I think those are important pieces of information for our listeners to take back as they're looking at planning, because I think telephone outreach can be a difficult thing for a board of directors to feel comfortable signing on to. So it's important to understand how it becomes integrated and what rates of success you can expect. And, of course, with your 25 years experience and with the integration that you bring to programs, you know, you're sharing that you can expect with a professional program that's well integrated and well planned to reach 70% of your donor base. Well, you're certainly not going to know that you've reached 70% of your donor base with direct mail alone. And you're certainly not going to get that kind of response rate. When you're looking at your donor base and you have reached the sort of the mark that you've set, 70%, what donation rate would you expect in an average program? Obviously, it depends on, you know, how active the program has been and how current the donors are. But in an average program where you're able to reach 70% of your donors, what would you expect the donation rate to be?
Sure. That's obviously, as I'm sure you're aware, a pretty complex question because it also depends on the organization.
That's right.
But I'll try to take a crack at it as best I can. If you're in a university setting, then you've got current donors who are 1 year out, so between, I'll call that between 12 and 18 months out, you're going to get a pledge rate from that the group that you've reached, which is going to be 75% to 80% of renewals. And
that,
if the program is well run,
if I can stop you there, so 75% to 80% of 70% of your donor base are likely to give. Again, you're as a university, and so there's a high affinity rate there. Well, that same university is not likely to see that rate of return in direct mail alone or in email.
Not even close. It's going to require a significant amount of mailings. They'll probably have to mail 6-7 times a year, and they still won't achieve that amount of return. And where the big difference here comes in the average gift size. Because if you have an opportunity to speak to someone and ask them for a specific amount of money, you're likely to raise more than if you send a direct mail piece. I mean, we've seen that from all of the numbers. And we also do direct mailings where people who made a $200 gift in the past are likely to just write another check for $200. If you have an opportunity to ask them to stretch their way towards making a $400 gift, et cetera, they may be able to do that.
All right. And do you have statistics that show that it also, the phone calling also affects direct mail and email? In other words, is there a lift across the board because of the ability to have a conversation with someone as opposed to just expecting them to open the email or open the letter, read it, and come to the conclusion themselves rather than having a dialogue?
There's usually a significant lift in direct mail. We've seen trends where even when we don't reach someone, when they receive a direct mail piece or upgrade on their own, because they've read the letter potentially that we sent as a pre-call, which had a specific ask amount on it, they may have dodged the call, but it's a call to action to them to give more when they get the next direct mail solicitation.
Mm-hmm.
What we've also found is that when you're reaching out to folks and actually having a conversation with them and thanking them, obviously that generates better support long-term, even through direct mail. And we've seen those trends when we have a program. Likely it can deter from having an average gift size that's higher with the phone. A lot of nonprofits like to send out direct mail first and then call to those that are non-respondents. When we've seen that happen, what you've essentially done is taken out the best donors who are going to respond to that direct mail and potentially upgrade from an opportunity to actually reach out and try to upgrade them over the phone and thank them. And, you know, I know people say, well, I don't like receiving phone calls. Well, if you have a credible reason to go to them and thank them and tell them what's going on within your organization, I don't see why nonprofits should ever be apologizing for making a thank you call and being good stewards of how those gifts are being used, which is what you're doing when you're actually having a dialogue.
And I think that's, again, it's just over time, because there certainly are lots of folks out there who make very bad phone calls, who do abuse the privilege of having a conversation. So it puts, I think, more of the emphasis for our listeners today to enter into this with eyes wide open and understanding that, we're not promoting one firm over another, but working with professionals who have a long history of experience and doing that in multiple sectors. Because as you mentioned, you know, you shared some statistics that you would expect from a university setting. You would expect in other settings that those numbers would be less, but still in an integrated campaign, more than direct mail or email by themselves.
Indeed. I mean, if you look at healthcare, that same number we discussed of 75 to 80% for current donors would be more like 50 to 55%. And as I always like to say, when I speak across the country, you're only as good as your last visit when it comes to healthcare. So there it becomes
That's
even
right.
more critical that you have that personal touch because out of
That's
sight,
right.
out of mind, they could use another healthcare provider. So it becomes even more important to have that touch. And then the other difficult thing that in healthcare that boards have a hard time wrapping around when they're presented with is that acquisition in healthcare really becomes a break-even proposition. There isn't the same type of connection when you're an alum at a university as when you're a grateful patient at a hospital. So in essence, the board needs to decide that it's worth buying donors because it's going to be break-even, even with telephone calls. With direct mail, usually it's more expensive. With phone, you can break even making acquisition calls. But they're buying donors. Those donors will then renew the following year at 50 to 60%. So you're able to build a base over time. The problem with institutions like I just read recently, as I'm sure you did, that Stanford stopped making phone calls altogether. The problem with that strategy is that long term, you're not building that base and moving people up the giving pyramid from the bottom up. And so when the major gifts dry out, when those mid-level donors are no longer there, you're left with a real dilemma, even with your major gift solicitations, because there's no pool being pushed up the giving pyramid.
Yeah, because it becomes a very short-sighted view, you know, just as, you know, sort of the flip side of that is a board of directors that looks at the amount of money that comes in through an acquisition campaign versus a planned giving campaign or a legacy campaign, and makes the decision that they're only going to do planned giving because
right.
that's where the money is. Well, yeah, that's nice if you've had someone that came before you who took the time to build a thoughtful giving program and build those relationships, because it's not all that often, and certainly not enough for a program to succeed, for someone to only make a planned gift, to have not had a relationship and to have not had that relationship cultivated over time, that would be quite rare. And with that, I'm going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to actually have you talk to us about something that probably people don't expect us to talk about today on the Ultimate Telephone Success Podcast, and that is the use of the telephone in planned giving. So how does that work? And we will be right back after this break.
When you have a great idea and need to work with others to bring it to life, how do you do it? Sometimes it's tough because the people you work with are in different places, with different schedules, using different devices. Google Apps lets you bring ideas to life with others. Here's how. Start with email that offers more. Gmail does more than send and receive emails. It connects people and lets you chat instantly while viewing a snapshot of your team's relevant activities and access to everything they've shared with you. With Google Docs, there's only one version for everyone to work on. Share easily with the right people without email attachments or compatibility hassles. And work together on the same docs at the same time, in a way that simply makes sense. Edit and interact easily with integrated social commenting. Google Calendar makes it easy to share schedules and find times to meet, and schedule or update meetings with a few clicks. Everyone can't be in the same place at the same time, but Google Apps lets you work together from any place. With multi-way video chat, you'll feel like you're all in the same room. While screen sharing and integration with Google Docs lets you work with more people from anywhere, on any device, even on your mobile phone or tablet. Work with any team at any time, from any place, on any device. Google Apps. Work in the future, today. To learn more, go to google.com/apps.
And programming note, the Nonprofit Coach radio show will be on break for the next couple of weeks, as I will be on business in Europe. I will actually be dedicating a clock tower in Bulgaria, in Vodice, Bulgaria, for a donor program that we have been instituting in that for that village for a number of years. Then I will have some partner meetings in Zurich and some partner meetings in London before heading back. And when I get back, we will be having the big nonprofit coach radio show, big seventh anniversary show. If you can believe, this show will be turning 7 years young on April 18th at 12 noon Eastern. And our producer, Diane Peach, has been working on an incredible lineup of luminaries who will be coming on, sharing their best tips, talking about their time on the show, and making sure that everyone goes away from our big seventh anniversary show with a lot of tips that they can take right into their program to make their next year a big success. So make sure you mark your calendar, April 18th, 12 noon Eastern. We will be here for our big seventh anniversary show.
Remember, our podcasts and archives are always available 24 hours a day at tedhart.com. Click on radio links. If you're listening live today, the phone lines are open. Call in and ask a question by dialing 347-324-3080. Now, back to the Nonprofit Coach with Ted Hart.
And we are back here live with Anthony Alonzo, president of Advantage Plus, 25 years experience in direct marketing, and he is helping us today prepare you with the Ultimate Telephone Success podcast. Anthony, planned giving by phone? Wow, you got to fill in the blanks on that one.
Sounds crazy. after 20 years in the business, about 5 years ago, somebody said, have you ever tried this? And I was a skeptic, and I've been doing this for years, using telephone outreach and solicitation, I said. But I was approached by a client. We've got a base of prospects, and we want to identify some folks for planned giving opportunities. And I said, well, we'll take a crack at developing something. And thus was born a process where we use a pre-call letter, which is more of a thank you than a solicitation, signed by a volunteer who's made the ultimate gift to the nonprofit. That's then followed up by your listeners can do this on their own. It's followed up by a caller. In our particular case, our corporate headquarters is in Vegas, and we have callers there who calls to thank the donor and to identify interest. Once there's an identification of interest, that call then gets passed on plan giving professional who closes the gift. Now, in our particular case, we have plan giving professionals with 20 plus years experience all across the country who take those calls on from our callers in Vegas. We call them tier two specialist callers. So they've worked at different nonprofits everywhere in the country. In the case of some of your listeners, it's a matter of handing it off to their plan giving officers or their major gift officers to then follow up on that. What we found is that the reason people aren't making bequests, the reason people aren't making planned gifts, is because they're not being asked. Because most organizations have a small budget with one planned giving director, and they can't reach out to the masses. So we do a lot of, as you mentioned earlier, with the regular phoning, we do a lot of analysis of the data before we actually select prospects for the planned giving calling. And what we're looking at is loyalty. How many folks have given for 20 consecutive years, for 15? The amount is not as important as the longevity in terms of the loyalty is what we found in our testing, and who's more likely to make a bequest or some sort of planned gift. It's really based on number of years of giving, not the amount.
Mm-hmm. So in looking at the data, you then pull that out. Walk us through sort of how does that phone call happen, because this would seem to me to be, again, here on the Ultimate Telephone Success podcast, this is sort of the ultimate telephone call for the ultimate gift, because it's highly complex, it's very personal, but what you're talking about is turning giving into a legacy. So how do you do that, and how do you start that dialogue by phone?
Well, the initial dialogue is as I said, from a you can even use a volunteer caller who is following up on a letter that they've received thanking them, where that volunteer is telling their own personal story as to why they've made the ultimate gift. Then it's followed up by a caller who thanks them for all of their years of giving and who engages them in a conversation about that giving and asks them again about that letter and whether they've ever thought about making a planned gift or an estate gift, whether they have any interest in that. The moment that there's some interest, that gets handed out, that call would get handed off, an appointment would be made to speak to someone who knows about all those complexities, so that you're not expecting the volunteer caller or your student caller or even one of our callers from our calling center to actually be able to speak to those complexities. We're then transferring that appointment over to either a plan giving professional at the institution or to one of our plan giving professionals. And as I said, we have folks all across the country. Every single one of them has 20 plus years experience in plan giving to the nonprofit sector. So they're very familiar on all the intricacies of that and closing the gift. They've also been trained by the institution, if you happen to hire a firm like mine. So they've met with the institution and they've trained with the institution. So they become an extension of the plan giving office of the institution.
And a knowledgeable extender who can have a conversation and knows what questions to ask, what clues to listen to determine whether or not this is could become a serious prospect. So this is really a way to identify really good prospects for your planned giving in a way that you might have to have a lot of events, you might have to talk to a lot of people, and when you're lightly staffed in this professional arena, is there any other way to do that?
There isn't. I mean, we can reach 1,000 folks in 2 months. That would take a planned giving director probably 8 years, if not longer, to reach that same number. So, I mean, those programs are relatively small. They're 500 or 1,000 names because we're reaching out to a select group of prospects. But let me give you an idea from a client that lets me share numbers, a prep school in Pennsylvania, the Hill School, where we took on a program for them and reached out to 1,000 people. We came back with over $5 million in closed plan gifts, mostly bequest, from 1,000 people.
So that was
money that was left on the table.
So this wasn't just teeing up prospects. You actually, through the process, were able to close bequests.
That's correct. Over 5 million. Those specialist callers that we have actually will close the bequest. They're trained professionals in plan giving, and they become an extension. And in other words, a part-time plan giving officer for the institution. And so we handed back 5 million in closed bequests to that institution. And we've done that with healthcare and several other clients. But that's a client which we've got showcased on our website and we use in our marketing materials. So I always like to point out to them because obviously we have permission to use their name. So these programs could be very successful, whether they're done in-house or outsourced. Most of the outsourcing you see out there are just identification programs. Somebody's calling saying, are you interested? And then handing it back to the institution. My problem with that, as I'm sure you know, Ted, from years of experience, is that so many nonprofits just have limited budgets. So if you're handing back 200, 250 leads that may be qualified, they still have to try to reach those 200 to 250 leads.
Yeah, I mean, what does that really get them if they still don't have the staff to follow up, right?
That's correct. And that's why we developed this process where we, in essence, hire plan giving professionals to close the gifts for our clients.
Yeah, so it's sort of like hiring a virtual information technology person, or you've got basically a virtual plan giving staff that then becomes available to you to be able to have authoritative questions and answer sessions with folks who already care about you.
That's correct. And they would respond to any request as if they were working with the institution. Branded with the institutional information. In this particular case, Advantage becomes transparent. It looks and feels like it's someone from the institution.
It's an innovative approach, but it builds off from other methods that are already being used, and probably, you know, again, not thinking of planned giving, thinking of that as being, you know, very individual, very high end. But again, because it's so individual and because it's so private, even having, you know, big planned giving seminars or something of that sort that is sort of the dream of most nonprofits to get prospects together to learn about planned giving, ultimately, this is something that should be handled privately and should have the opportunity for people to have private discussions with individuals. And so basically bringing a larger team to that market, just by the very nature of it, is likely to unearth additional opportunities.
And a lot less expensive than hiring three or five planned giving directors.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. We've got about 7 minutes left here on the show. I know, surprise, there's just so much to cover. But rounding out the Ultimate Telephone Success podcast, what else do we need to make sure we share with the audience today from your experience if they really want to be using the telephone as part of an integrated fundraising campaign successfully?
I think the key is going back to what I said initially, and that's personalization. We are in a business where raising friends is our primary responsibility. Stewardship is our primary responsibility. And so every whether you outsource and are looking at firms, you should listen to their phone calls. You should listen to their callers. You should go visit them. Too many times I feel that, you know, folks are outsourcing their most precious commodity to a firm without doing the research. Make sure that that firm is hiring quality people to represent you if you are doing that. If you are doing it internally, make sure that you are letting go people who are not representing you well. A lot of times nonprofits hire people who are not effective, and then they're afraid to let them go for a variety of reasons. They don't want to upset somebody. There's politics involved. But you want people who will represent you on the phone, who are personalizing the approach, who are good stewards, and who are leaving everybody they speak to feeling good about the institution.
Yeah, and again, while you can have the volunteers involved in the process, even having volunteers involved should be professionally managed.
That's correct. And many times it's not. And again, for a variety of reasons that we've spoken about, if you tell a volunteer, here's the ask amount, it's 200, and they don't ask the person for 200, they say, can you do the same thing you did last year? It's hard to manage that person, but you've got to manage that person and say, here's what we're trying to achieve. Here's why we want you to make that ask, that specific ask.
That's right.
And very politely ask them to not come back if they're not doing that, in fact. Because at the end of the day, it's hurting your program and your ability to upgrade your donors. And that's what you're doing it for.
So now looking at the time, only a few minutes left here. What are those key things that anyone listening to this podcast should be asking of a firm, should be doing when they engage a firm? You said, you know, make sure that you go and actually listen to live calls. What are some of the other things that should be taken into consideration to determine whether or not this is the firm for you, this is the firm that you can trust with your prospects and donors?
Well, I always like to say it's centered around the callers, always centered around the callers. So listen to calls either remotely, which most firms can allow you to do, or go visit the firm in person if you have the opportunity and the budget to do it. The next thing would be find out who their callers are and who they hire. The average age of our caller is 57. We purposely hire folks with life experience. We want them to have conversations. We don't want them reading a script. Ask the firm whether they're willing to bring their callers to you for training. You know, it makes all the difference. One of our clients, for example, is the U.S. Military Academy. We fly our callers to West Point every year for a tour. We think it's imperative that they get a feel for the organization. Ask them whether they're willing to do that. Make sure that they're sending out some sort of pre-call piece ahead of the phone call. and that they're working with you on data implementation and planning, and they have that in-depth analysis. And I would say make sure that you're speaking to other clients of theirs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also talk to us just very briefly about testing of campaigns to get the methodology right, because there isn't just one approach in terms of, you know, email, phone, direct mail, phone, email, you know, in other words, what is the right approach? Should, like everything else in fundraising, be tested and then go back and hone the strategy to meet the particulars of your program and your donor base?
I think that's a very good point, Ted, and I'm glad you brought it up. Testing is critical. Ask the firm whether they'll do testing or do testing yourself. Some folks are going to be better off, younger folks, for example, solicited through email. They're not picking up their phone. But you don't want to assume that. You want to test. You want to do a small mailing. One of the critical things when you're doing these pre-call mailings is if you're going to reach out to 10,000 people, you don't mail out to 10,000 people at once and try to reach them within a week. You stagger the mailings. Send out 1,000 letters. Follow that up. What that does is it gives you an opportunity to identify whether the letter is working, whether the ask and answer are working, and then change your strategy. Tinker with it as you go along. Identify which groups or segments in your database are not responding well to the telephone solicitation. Pull them out. Move them to a direct mail or an email solicitation. See how they do there.
That's right.
So, I mean, those are critical things in any program and things we like to do. We don't mail to everybody at once because I feel I have a responsibility to my clients to go back at the end, to not go back at the end and go, this didn't work because. I'd rather
fix it
as we go along.
Anthony, I'm gonna have to say we have now finished all of our best advice, the Ultimate Telephone Success Podcast. Just round it out for us by making sure that our listeners know how they can reach you.
Sure. Our website is www.afrcplus.com. I could be reached at anthony@afrcplus.com. And you can feel free to reach us on our toll-free number at 855-575-7587. If you want to reach me directly, my extension is 101.
Terrific. Anthony Alonzo, President of Advantage Plus, thank you for being our guest here on The Nonprofit Coach, and we have posted your website over on the Facebook feed. Thanks, everyone.
You've been listening to the Nonprofit Coach Radio Show with Ted Hart. Tell all your friends to check out our production schedule and download our iPod and iPad-friendly podcasts at tedhart.com. Thanks for listening to The Nonprofit Coach.